Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And coming up a little later in the programme, Washington's decision to send anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine, despite the fact that many countries, including Ukraine, are signatories to a treaty banning their use. We'll hear why the Biden administration's reversed its position and what it might mean for Ukraine on the battlefield. Also, we'll be speaking to the Australian novelist Richard Flanagan about becoming the first writer to win a top prize for fiction and now a prestigious prize for non-fiction. That's in about 15 minutes. But we are going to begin in Hong Kong. And if you were listening yesterday, you'll have heard us talking about the 45 democracy activists who were sent to prison after being found guilty of threatening the territory's national security law, a sweeping piece of legislation imposed by Beijing to clamp down on protest and dissent. Well, today, the highest profile figure to fall foul of that law appeared in court for the first time. He's Jimmy Lai, the multi-millionaire media tycoon who's long campaigned for media freedom in Hong Kong through his publications, including the popular tabloid Apple Daily, now closed down. He's already in prison on other charges. But here he is speaking to NewsHour in August 2020, when he was briefly released on bail following his initial arrest under the national security law.
That's not the first time I was arrested. I was arrested two or three times before. This time they said there is national security law, which is more scary. I just forgot how I felt. You know, I just asked them, okay, can I go up and have a bath and change because I just finished my exercise? And they said, no, let's make it quick, but we have to follow you. You can't close the door when you bath. The police has to be outside watching me. And that's very unusual. Last time was not as serious as this.
And this is serious. Breaches of the national security law carry sentences of up to life in prison. Well, Danny Vincent is the BBC's reporter in Hong Kong. So what exactly is Jimmy Lai accused of?
Jimmy Lai is considered perhaps the biggest target of the Beijing-imposed national security law. He's been accused of publishing seditious material with his newspaper Apple Daily, which is now closed. He's also been accused of colluding with foreign forces. Now, the prosecutors, the authorities say that these charges are so serious, they're actually comparable to murder.
He appeared today in court to begin his defence. What did he say?
Jimmy Lai looked noticeably thinner compared to 4 years ago when he was first detained. He also looked older. You could see that he'd aged. This was the first time that he took to the stand in 4 years. And many observers and journalists feel that Jimmy Lai used this opportunity to speak out. He defended his former publication, Apple Daily. He said that it was founded and was aligned with the core values of Hong Kong. He said this was freedom, freedom of speech, the pursuit of democracy, freedom of assembly. So he defended very strongly his right to found that newspaper. He also denied the allegations that he had colluded with foreigners. His defence lawyer presented some of the evidence that the prosecutor had used to accuse Jimmy Lai. It showed a diagram of many political leaders and politicians around the world that Jimmy had been accused of colluding with. Jimmy went through all the questions, he went through all these profiles of these individuals, explaining how he met them. Some he said he didn't actually know, and attempted to try to debunk the allegations and the claims that the authorities have made against him.
You mentioned that he was looking older. I mean, and that is the point, given the seriousness of the charges against him, isn't it? I mean, he is 76, and I suppose the fear of all those around him, including his family, that if he is convicted, I mean, he'll never leave prison, will he?
Well, the national security law is obviously a very serious law, and the prosecutor and the authorities, they believe that Jimmy is guilty of very serious crimes. Now, under this law, if found guilty, he could be in prison for the rest of his life. That's what the law states. Jimmy Lai is 76 years old. He's already been in detention for 4 years. He's been in solitary confinement that entire time. We do know that he has some health issues, but I think the fact that he's staying in solitary confinement and he's a 76-year-old man and it's been 4 years, yes, that's of great concern to his loved ones, his supporters and his family.
I mean, he has been a very powerful and a very rich man, and he could have, I guess, kept his head below the parapet. I mean, you've interviewed him before. What's he said in the past about why he feels the need to speak out about these issues of freedom and democracy in Hong Kong?
Well, I spoke to Jimmy Lai just hours before he was detained under the national security law. He's a very courageous man. I think many people see him as a symbol, one of the symbols of the pro-democracy movement. When I spoke to him on that day, he said that he thinks that fear is the cheapest way that the authorities use to control people. Now, it was interesting. Jimmy Lai's been speaking out for around 25 years, and he's been saying pretty much the same message throughout that time. He's always said that this day possibly could come. He's always said that he would stay in Hong Kong, he'd stand with Hong Kong, and he'd be willing to face the consequences of his actions.
And that was the BBC's Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. Well, Mark Simon is a former executive at that newspaper, Apple Daily, and a longtime friend of Jimmy Lai. What are his feelings as the trial gets underway?
Honestly, I'm immensely proud of him. I've known Jimmy for 22 years, and he's been waiting for this day for really about 4 years, and he's going to be on the stand for 3 weeks. And he went up there, and he just told the truth. He didn't say anything or talk to anybody about things that were, he didn't try to deflect. He just said, this is the way it is, and that's exactly the way I know it to be. And I thought he did a very, very admirable job on his first day.
Is he going to get a fair trial?
No, he's convicted. He's convicted. They may sit up there in wigs, but there's a guy in a Mao cap who's already made that decision. This is just basically, as far as I'm concerned, the real thing that's going to happen here is Beijing has probably looked at this case, because it's a Hong Kong operation, and said, you know what, this really is not what we thought it was. And Jimmy Lai was not the person of, let's just say, bringing down the streets and the conspirator that they thought he was. He's a press freedom guy. I mean, everything Jimmy did was really about defending Apple Daily all the way through. And I hope that comes out, and I think it will.
Yes, I mean, as we've been hearing, he was a tireless campaigner for media freedom. But I just wonder, has that essentially been closed down now in Hong Kong?
It is. In other words, he said today, he said, I was right. In other words, you know, I was worried Article 20, I was worried the national security law would crush press freedom. And he basically said it on the stand. He said, and I was right. So he knows. He knows enough, even though he's in prison, that it's over for press freedom.
Do you think the authorities in Beijing are also looking to make an example of Jimmy Lai? And I just wonder whether that feeds into the idea that actually, if people are afraid to speak out, well, they won't.
Well, I think absolutely the idea is to make an example of Jimmy, just like it was to make an example of the 45 people they sentenced yesterday, and even a young man who was arrested for showing disrespect to the national flag and the national anthem at a football match the other day. So in other words, it's constantly with these regimes, the idea is to instill fear. Jimmy's very special in the sense that basically, you're going after a very wealthy, powerful man. And early on, that became, in my mind, that became very clear to me that what they were trying to show everybody is no one is above the law in our law. No one is above us coming after them. And that was very clear.
Did he think, though, that he might have been able to get away with it? In other words, did he just push the system imposed by Beijing, too far?
Jimmy was very, before he went to jail, he and I would talk almost every day. And he was very aware of what was coming. I mean, Jimmy knew he was going to jail. It's kind of ironic when you see the government saying Jimmy's legal team is doing this or somebody's doing that. The boss knew. He knew what was coming his way. He didn't push too hard, though. We just kind of know. I mean, when they're encroaching on freedoms, we're the ones who are standing there. In other words, we haven't changed. We're still doing what we do. And they're trying to push you back. Jimmy just wouldn't get pushed back. And that meant that we were done. As it did mean that other people were done too, such as Stand News and other publications. In other words, we're not the only publication that was put out of business.
He said at the beginning, he will be convicted. I mean, is there any hope for his case? And I just wonder, you know, with Donald Trump starting his second term in January, he's promised to get Jimmy Lai out. I mean, can he? Will that make any difference, a new president in the White House?
I think the main thing is going to rely with the UK. In other words, he's a British citizen. He's proud of his British citizenship. And he's hoping this PM, who frankly was very, very, very grateful to see him raise this with Xi Jinping the other day, Donald Trump can provide the impetus to show the Chinese it's just easier if you let him go. He's basically said, I was here to defend media freedom. It's gone. I'm perfectly content to go walk the streets of London.
But does the UK have any leverage in this, do you think?
I think the UK does. I'm not one of these ones who really doesn't think the UK has leverage. I think the fact is the Chinese, they need a calm, quiet playing field to succeed in their economic activities. They need to grow. And I think if the UK leads with the US and with Canada, who's been wonderful, and the Australians have been wonderful, I think if you lead, they lead with those and they let the Chinese know, look, we won't have to go through this every single day. If that we have meetings and things like that, if you guys just do the right thing here, he's 77 years old. The other thing that's happening too is Jimmy is becoming very popular on the mainland. There's no doubt about that. We're hearing that left, right, and center. Why keep making him popular? It's the easiest thing to do. It's what we would call a layup in America to let Jimmy Lai go, convict him, and then kick him out.
So do you and his family, who I know you obviously know and are in touch with, I mean, do you still hope that you will see him again and he won't die in prison, basically?
My hope is he will not die in prison. But look, Stanley Prison, I've been there many times. It's an old prison. That's a rough summer. That's a rough, rough summer. There's no air conditioning. You're in a stone cell. He's in solitary confinement. It's not going well. The solitary confinement, maybe that maybe was fine during COVID because it maybe protected him, but nobody asked for solitary confinement for 4 years. And I do worry about him. He's 77, he's diabetic, and I'm not worried about his spirit, I'm worried about his body. And so I would like to see him out. I hope I'll see him out, and I'm actually fairly positive. And I think the thing is that it's not something that's impossible. It's very possible to get him out.
And that was Mark Simon, longtime friend of the Hong Kong media tycoon Jimmy Lai, and indeed a former executive at his Apple Daily. Mark was speaking to me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And coming up later on the programme, we'll be asking, should a country with a poor record on human and civil rights, such as Azerbaijan, be given the right to host the COP29 climate talks?
We now know where it leads. It leads to over 300 political prisoners. It leads to a situation in which climate policy is whitewashed or greenwashed. So what we know is the objective is not being reached by the way the international community has been dealing with Azerbaijan until now.
We'll be discussing that in half an hour. Our main headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour: anti-landmine campaigners have condemned Washington's decision to provide anti-personnel mines to Ukraine. More on that in about 15 minutes. And reports from Sudan say dozens of civilians have been killed in a suspected attack by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces on a village in the centre of the war-torn country. This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Now, this celebrated Australian novelist Richard Flanagan has just become the first writer to win both the prestigious Booker Prize for Fiction, that was in 2014, and today the equally prestigious Bailey Gifford Prize for Non-Fiction. That's for his latest book, Question 7. The chair of the judging panel, frequent NewsHour guest Isabel Hilton, described it as an astonishingly accomplished meditation on memory, history, trauma, love and death. Well, Richard Flanagan lives in Tasmania, the island off Australia's southeast coast. And a little earlier, I spoke to him from there and I asked him first what he was trying to achieve with Question 7.
You know, I think at the end of that strange dream that was COVID, there was a sense that everyone had, you know, people wanted to understand what it is to live, you know, to love. What is it to be, you know? And you saw that expressed in everything from the Great Resignation in the West to the Lie Flat movement in places like China. So I wanted to try and understand what it meant to live, you know, what were the things that really moved people beneath the surface reality of jobs and obligations and duties.
And what do you think that is? I mean, is it love and relationships?
Yeah, I think it's always about love. And it's about kindness and goodness. That they're the food that keeps us going. You know, I think without hope we have nothing. And I think there is a lot to have hope for. You know, I think if you take your compass from power, from your daily feeds off your phone, and you look to the powerful, if you look to politics, you'll find only despair. But if you look to those around you, your friends and your family, in their strange, confused and contradictory ways, their fallible ways, just like us. But you find hope, you find kindness and goodness. And it was just trying to honour that. It's not the basis of politics or ideology or religion, but it is an answer to the meaninglessness we sometimes feel is the universe beyond us. You know, what I saw with my parents is they practiced this idea of love, and they believed in an idea of love, and they fought for that idea of love. And over the decades, that became their hard-won truth. It became a reality. And what I thought of as being naive when I was young, I realised when I was older that the naivety was mine alone, that that was actually a form of magic, and they the magicians.
Why have you decided to reject, at least for now, the money for the prize?
Well, I accepted the prize money, but just delayed its receipt until there was some sign from Bailey Gifford, some public sharing of plans to further minimise their investment in fossil fuels. And I should say, I think Bailey Gifford are not bad actors. They're a fund manager that have got some minimal investments in fossil fuels. But I can't write a book which in part is about the destruction of the natural world because of the climate crisis and then accept money from at this point. But I believe Bailey Gifford have been a force for good for literature. And I believe we're all guilty. We're all in this together. And it's about trying to find a way together forward. And, I've already had a conversation with one of the partners. And, I will be speaking to the other partners. That they're very open to that. And I hope some good can come of this. So I think together we can do better.
The Australian writer Richard Flanagan. We did approach Bailey Gifford, the fund manager that sponsors that prize, for a comment. We got this quote from one of the partners, Peter Singlehurst, who said, "Congratulations to Richard for winning the two most coveted accolades in the realm of literature. We look forward to welcoming him to Edinburgh and continuing the conversation." Now, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are facing an increasing number of attacks by Israeli settlers and violence from the Israeli military as the olive picking season approaches its peak. According to the UN, this year Palestinian farmers are confronting greater risks due to restrictions on their movement and threats from settlers, severely undermining their livelihoods and exposing them to physical harm. Wira Davis reports.
The sound of a middle-aged woman being attacked by a masked man with a large wooden stick. Zuraya Abad instinctively winces as she watches a video of the incident in which her ribs were broken.
That's the guy that attacked you?
Yes.
With a baseball bat?
Yes. I cannot breathe. I cannot breathe.
The Israeli peace activist had been helping Palestinian farmers pick their olives when she was assaulted without provocation. Rather than arresting her attacker, Israeli soldiers who had accompanied Jewish settlers to the site just told them to move on.
Even when we come, it doesn't guarantee that Palestinians can reach their lands and harvest the olives. It's not like we come and we are some sort of superpower. We try to raise awareness.
The situation now is very dangerous because they have guns, the settlers. This is the difference. Everybody afraid to die.
A week before Zaria was attacked, the funeral took place of 59-year-old Hanan Abu Salami. She was shot and killed, reportedly by an Israeli soldier, while picking olives in the northern West Bank on her own land. The IDF says it's investigating the incident. Harvesting olives, like here in the village of Safa, is an age-old ritual, but an economic necessity for many Palestinians. It is, says the UN, increasingly precarious. Farmers across the West Bank, regarded internationally as Palestinian land, but occupied by Israel, face heightened risks, like blocked roads and attacks by settlers. Omar Tanatara is an olive farmer from Safa and is a member of the village council.
Last year we couldn't even harvest our olives, except for a very small amount. And then the army came and threw the olives on the ground and ordered us to go home. Some people were even shot at. Olive trees were cut down with saws. That's how we found them.
After being gathered by hand, sacks full of olives are taken to the nearby factory. The presses have started this season, but income was well down last year, and this year will be even worse, says factory owner Abd al-Rahman Khalifa, as even fewer farmers are able to harvest their crop.
Let me give you an example. My brother-in-law in eastern Lebanon, next to the Israeli settlement, went to pick his own olives, but they broke his arms and they made him leave with all the people that were with him.
On the hill overlooking the olive groves of Safa stands an illegal Jewish outpost, a farm. The extremist settler who runs it was sanctioned by the UK and other Western governments for repeated acts of violence against Palestinians. Over the last year of the war in Gaza, Jewish settlers have been emboldened by the support of far-right Israeli ministers like Itamar Ben-Gvir, encouraging them to assert their right to what they say is their God-given land, irrespective of Palestinian ownership or international law. At a recent rally on the Gaza border, the minister openly called for the Jewish resettlement of Gaza and what he described as giving Arabs the option of leaving land in Gaza and the West Bank. A farmer loads sacks full of olives onto the back of a donkey, waiting patiently in the shade of an olive tree. The tree has been a symbol of this land for centuries. For generations of Palestinians, it is their link to the land, a link that is under threat now more than ever.
And that was the BBC's Wira Davis reporting. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up. Welcome back to NewsHour. More than 1,900 people who claim their cancer was caused by talcum powder are launching legal action against the company responsible for selling it. Johnson & Johnson has strongly denied claims it knew of alleged links between its baby powder and asbestos, an industrial material and known carcinogenic, and denied any link between its product and cancer. The company has been sued repeatedly in America, but this is the first time lawyers have represented claimants outside of the United States. Let's talk to the BBC's Charlie Haynes, who's been following the story. Hi, Charlie. What's the background to this?
Hi, James. So Johnson's baby powder will probably sit in bathroom cabinets around the world. It's used for changing babies to wick away moisture, often used as a deodorant. But it's existed for the last few years with a bit of a cloud around it, particularly in the US, where there's been repeated lawsuits. And now, for the first time outside of the US, it's looking like this action's starting to spread, where women, mostly women, are launching action in the UK against the company. Now, those allegations are centering around claims that talcum powder has for years sometimes contained asbestos, which is, as you say, a known carcinogen.
And what does Johnson & Johnson say about these claims?
Johnson & Johnson have strongly disputed these allegations, describing them as plainly wrong and that they defy logic, rewrite history and ignore the facts. They insist that talc poses no danger to users, and they point to the fact that they've won many of the court cases in the US. That said, the science between it is incredibly heavily disputed. There are experts on both sides who have disagreed about it. And proving a link between cancer and an individual's use of talc has proved very tricky. One of the things they said to us in a statement was they take issue with the issue of talc safety incredibly seriously, and they always have. And they say, as their documents show, they rely on the most state-of-the-art testing protocols and have done for decades, and have been entirely transparent with government institutions and academic researchers regarding their findings.
What about these questions about asbestos?
So asbestos is an industrial material. It's used in shipbuilding. It was used as a construction material for a lot of the second half of the 20th century. It stopped being used as people found out it was a carcinogen. But the link with talc is about a mineral. So both talc and asbestos are what geologists would call a silicate mineral, which means essentially they can be found in the same mines. And that's how the lawyers acting for the plaintiffs or the claimants would allege that these small amounts of asbestos would make its way into talcum powder.
And Charlie, in the 30 seconds we've got remaining, what about, you know, people listening? They've got baby powder in their cupboards. What about that? What happens with the legal action?
Yeah, so the company is now using cornstarch instead of mineral talc. They withdrew it in North America in 2020 and stopped selling it worldwide, that's the mineral talc, last year, blaming what they called a campaign of misinformation. They insist that the mineral talc has always been safe. Now, in terms of the legal action in the UK,
just briefly,
the lawyers have started legal action with a pre-action letter. They expect to be in court next year.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Charlie Haynes reporting for us there. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Now, in these, the final weeks of the Biden administration, there's been a flurry of announcements about increasing military support for Ukraine. First, it was allowing Kyiv to use American long-range missiles on targets within Russia. And today, it's a decision to send anti-personnel mines to Ukraine to try to slow Russia's advances, particularly along the front line in the east. Most countries ban the use of these mines, but officials said Kyiv had committed to not using them in built-up areas, and they are apparently mines designed to become inert after a few weeks. Jeffrey Stacey, a former State Department official and current advisor to the Biden administration on Ukraine, told the BBC why the sudden shift.
There's a rush because of the fear of Trump and the fear that he will basically end aid to Ukraine and or press it hard to capitulate to Putin entirely. Now, those are the extreme fears that we have.
Dr. Marina Myron is with the War Studies Department at King's College London. I asked her, first of all, how significant was this decision by the US in terms of Ukraine's war effort?
First of all, it depends on where Ukraine is going to use them. These are anti-personnel mines or different types of mines. That being said, Ukraine has already used mines, so did Russia. Therefore, I don't think that this is going to be a substantial shift. Yes, it's going to complicate Russia's operations, depending, of course, on the location of these mines, how they will be laid, how the Ukrainian combat engineers will work. And of course, the Russians will also need greater effort if these mines are used to send in their combat engineers to clear the mines before Russian troops can move.
How do you think they might use them? I mean, how might they slow down Russia's advances? And presumably we're talking about in the east mainly.
Most likely, they could place them around strategic locations to protect the flanks of the Ukrainian troops. But again, here is the downside. These mines don't discriminate between enemy combatants and Ukrainian forces. So Ukrainian forces would have to be told where these mines are. They would have to have a mine map in order to be able to avoid them themselves. But I do expect the Ukrainian forces to try to protect themselves because the Russians have been using this tactic going around. So they don't do frontal assaults anymore. They start with the flanks and then they try to surround the Ukrainians.
We're told these are non-persistent landmines in the jargon. In other words, they stop working after a few weeks. Do you know how reliable that mechanism is?
Unfortunately, I do not, because we don't have enough information on what type of mines these are, what do the tests say, what is the failure rate, because there will be a percentage of mines that do not stop working. Some might even stop working earlier. So those are the questions that would have to be asked. That being said, there is a convention that bans the use of anti-personnel mines, either type. And the U.S. is not a signatory party to that. However, Ukraine is. And now Ukraine is also considering withdrawing its signature in order to employ these anti-personnel mines. So they also create a legal issue aside from the fact that we don't know, do they actually stop functioning after 2 weeks, or is there going to be a danger to civilians who might be resettling those areas after the war ends or if a ceasefire is brokered?
But the fact that they're willing to break the convention or withdraw from the convention, I mean, do you think that that's a sign that the Ukrainians are really now desperate for anything to slow Russia's advances? And do you think that that Eastern Front, I mean, could it actually break up altogether?
It could potentially break up because the Russians have accelerated their pace. Now they have opened a new front in Chernihiv, which is in the vicinity of the capital of Kyiv, and that stretches the Ukrainian forces even more. And the Ukrainian forces have a severe personnel shortage, and the recruitment is not going as planned. The Ukrainians are being attacked along different axes. And of course, with a shortage of personnel, shortage of artillery shells, they have difficulties holding those key strategic logistical hub. And so, yes, if the Russians keep pushing at this pace, there is a risk, especially if we look to the south of Donetsk, which the Russians are controlling more or less, then it could happen in that location.
Dr. Marina Myron of King's College London. Well, neither Russia nor the US one of the 164 parties to the Ottawa Convention, also known as the Mine Ban Treaty, that prohibits the deployment and transfer of anti-personnel landmines. President Biden a couple of years ago revived an Obama-era policy that banned the transfer of US anti-personnel landmines outside the Korean Peninsula, but now has reversed that. Ukraine is a signatory to the treaty. Let's speak to Volodymyr Ariev, who's a Ukrainian MP for the opposition European Solidarity Party. Welcome to NewsHour. Should Ukraine then withdraw from that Ottawa Convention, do you think?
I do believe we should not withdraw, but derogation is on the table. We have now the question whether Ukraine remain an independent state and will be existed at all. So that's, I think that if we have no Ukraine, so no part four treaty will be. So now for us is the main task to stop Russian offense and to to stop their advances along the front line.
Right.
And this is the main question, what we have to
resolve. But the fact that you're accepting these from the US, I mean, puts you in breach of the treaty, doesn't it?
I do believe that we should accept it as well. As I don't think that it will be a mostly dangerous sort of mines like PFM-1 or more known as a Dragon Tooth that remains dangerous for population, for civilians in decades after the battles are over. So I think it will be the such sort of anti-personnel mines that could be disarmed and inert after a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the idea. Do you think, though, given the sort of political questions around this, do you think that it's worth accepting these? I mean, are they going to make much of a difference when it comes to slowing Russia's advances?
Russian tactic now is successful, as well as they have Ukraine, well, Ukrainian and Russian human resources for military purposes is very difficult to compare. Russian is much more higher. And their tactic now to use small but numerous units to walk on the flanks of Ukrainian fortifications and push them out from their position, from our positions. So the only the lines consist from the from the anti-personnel mine could really slow down Russian success, and this is what we really need for a while. I do believe that it could be effective.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. That was opposition Ukrainian MP Volodymyr Aliyev joining us live. Now, a hugely popular social media personality is facing fresh questions over his cryptocurrency dealings amid concerns he may have profited from misleading his fans. The YouTuber and professional wrestler Logan Paul has promoted cryptocurrencies to millions of his followers online, apparently causing prices in these investments to spike and leading to suggestions he could have profited from sales of any tokens he held. Well, the BBC's seen new evidence suggesting he promoted investments without revealing that he had a financial interest in them. Paul's also facing a multi-million dollar lawsuit over a failed crypto project called CryptoZoo. He denies any wrongdoing. Matt Shea has been investigating the influencer and sent us this report.
We've been investigating the influencer Logan Paul for nearly a year. His critics say he may have made personal gains by misleading his fans about cryptocurrencies. For this, he denies any wrongdoing. We traveled to interview him at his gym in Puerto Rico to ask him about his allegations in person.
You look different. I feel like a champ. You look different.
But it didn't go as planned.
I have to say, the real Logan Paul looks very different.
Did you come all over here to ask about how I look?
He sent a lookalike and trolled us.
Is Logan coming?
I'm right here, bud. This is your interview. What do you got?
Let's just get out of here. I'm not doing this.
And then a crowd of supporters came shouting abuse. The allegations relate to the way the influencer has used his social accounts to promote cryptocurrencies. Like in 2021, when at the height of his interest in crypto, he posted about an Elon Musk-themed meme coin to his global following. What he didn't say is that he may have been a secret holder of the token. Our investigation looked at an anonymous crypto account with close links to Logan Paul. We noticed the anonymous account was first funded by Logan Paul's public crypto account, then from his fan club's NFT project, and it purchased a large amount of the coin. Moments before the tweet, it bought almost $160,000 worth. When the market peaked 12 hours later, it sold its holding at roughly $120,000 profit. Shortly afterwards, the price crashed. So it appears an account with close connections to Logan Paul made a lot of money from that tweet by buying directly before and selling after. I went to the head office of the Securities and Exchange Commission. They regulate 40% of the world's capital markets from here in Washington, D.C. I asked their chair, Gary Gensler, about the laws around promoting crypto.
They're supposed to tell you if they get paid, how much they get paid, whether they own the tokens, whether they've made money on the tokens, whether they actually know something about the project. And we at the Securities and Exchange Commission have brought a number of cases in these areas over the years.
Gensler couldn't speak specifically about Paul, but he told us,
influencers, whatever their name might be, don't go out and tout something and mislead the public.
Because it's illegal.
Yeah, it's also wrong.
There are still questions around Paul's crypto activities, but instead of answering them, he chose to send a lookalike. In doing so, he appears to be ambivalent about what happens to fans who invested based on his endorsements. And with a class action claim filed for his failed CryptoZoo project, the allegations around Paul exploiting his significant platform to promote cryptocurrency continue to mount. Logan Paul has consistently denied any wrongdoing and blames other team members for the failure of the CryptoZoo project.
And that was the BBC's Matt Shea with that investigation. And the full investigation can be seen in a new BBC documentary. It's called Logan Paul, Bad Influence. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Still more to come on this edition of the programme. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Now, the government of Azerbaijan is using the COP29 climate summit, currently taking place in the capital, Baku, to suppress the work of environmental activists and other political opponents. That's according to the Climate Action Network, a group of nearly 2,000 climate groups. The government denies the accusation, saying they hold no political prisoners. But last week, NewsHour spoke to one dissident being held under house arrest, and he told us he was being detained for criticising the country's environmental record. And many observers have also pointed out how little protest there's been around the COP29 summit venue. These campaigners hummed and clicked their fingers after being told by the organisers they couldn't start chanting. Well, even before COP29, Azerbaijan was notorious for its lack of tolerance of criticism. In the most recent World Press Freedom Index, it came 164th out of 180 countries. I've been speaking to Florian Erminger, a Swiss activist who campaigns for greater civil rights in Azerbaijan, and Arzu Geybulla, an independent Azerbaijani journalist who now lives in exile in Istanbul in Turkey. To Arzu first.
I am a freelance journalist from Azerbaijan, and yet I cannot travel back to my country because of the work that I've done covering the election fraud, the work that I've done reporting on human rights violations and the situation with overall rights and freedoms in the country. I have not been able to travel back for the last 10 years, and so Istanbul has been my base since then.
And if you were to go back to Azerbaijan, what would happen to you?
I will likely be detained and questioned. And the second worst thing that can happen is that I can be arrested and face bogus criminal charges.
So is there any scope for journalists in Azerbaijan to investigate, for example, issues such as the country's record on tackling climate change?
I think the situation is at its worst it's ever been. And any journalism that looks into investigating anything, let alone climate, and the impact of climate change is becoming extremely difficult to do. The authorities have been successfully able to silence independent media outlets, mostly forcing them out of the country. And whoever is left is doing their work at great risk to their not only personal safety, but also professional career too.
So it sounds like the fact that Azerbaijan is hosting this big climate summit, COP29, I mean, instead of opening up the space for criticism, for argument, for debate, that things have actually got worse because it's hosting the summit. Is that fair?
That is fair. In fact, yesterday, a court in Baku, several courts in Baku actually, extended pretrial detention periods for a number of civil society activists and journalists who've been arrested since November of last year.
Let me bring in Florian Erminger. Florian, does that chime with your experience? Is there evidence that you've found that hosting COP29 has made things worse when it comes to media freedom?
Well, what Arzu Geybulayev speaks about is really this long decade of repression that only got worse from the moment when it was clear that Azerbaijan would be hosting COP. There is clear indication with the arrest of journalists, of civil society activists. There really has a clear intent to silence them all ahead of COP. And I think the emblematic case is the arrest of Anar Mamadli, who was not only arrested in December 2013 to then be released again 2 years later, but was then rearrested just weeks after he announced the launch of the climate justice initiatives ahead of COP.
What is it that the government of Azerbaijan is so afraid of? It is a major oil and gas producer. It makes up the bulk of its revenues. I mean, that is no secret. But what do you think it is so sensitive about?
Well, obviously, there's a lot to lose for them. We know that the revenues of the oil and gas doesn't necessarily go to the country, but actually goes to those around the people who control the country. So obviously, the more transparency, the more publicity there is, the more knowledge also there is of how this country is being governed, where the revenues go, and the corruption around it, the more there is at risk for the individuals governing the country and their direct entourage. So the crackdown ahead of COP is clearly linked to this. And it also shows, as we have seen now during COP, that the point of Azerbaijan in hosting COP was not to actually have a debate about the climate and environmental policies, whether global or national, but to promote itself abroad and to promote its oil and gas interests with those countries and those companies that are present at COP.
So, Florian, in your view, was it a major mistake to allow Azerbaijan to host the summit?
Well, I think what really the international community needs to ask itself is whether the global climate debate is well served by what we have been seeing these last 2 weeks, by an executive of an oil company also being in the chairmanship of the COP, using those posts to promote the interests of the oil company, not of COP, and whether the international community believes that we will be able to tackle the risks associated to climate change, but also climate change itself, by countries like Azerbaijan hosting COP.
Arzu, can I ask you this? Are you disappointed that more of the participants of this summit, COP29, haven't used the occasion to demand more of Azerbaijan when it comes to media freedom?
I am disappointed, but it's not just the participants that we need to hold to account. We also need to hold to account UNFCCC itself.
That's the UN agency that's organizing the summit, yeah.
Absolutely. Due to its selection criteria, due to this sort of outdated decision-making mechanism, because clearly it isn't working in countries like Azerbaijan.
Florian, do those issues matter to Azerbaijan's trade partners, or does the oil and gas that the country produces, is that really what matters the most?
What we know for sure is when you don't take action to protect human rights with a country like Azerbaijan, it doesn't lead to peace. It doesn't lead to regional stability. And so this naivety of the international community of thinking it will engage with Azerbaijan in order to maintain stability and in order to improve the situation, we now know where it leads. It leads to over 300 political prisoners. It leads to a situation in which climate policy is whitewashed or greenwashed. So what we know is the objective is not being reached by the way the international community has been dealing with Azerbaijan until now.
And that was Swiss rights activist Florian Erminger. I was also speaking to Azerbaijani journalist Arzu Geybullah, who lives in exile in Istanbul. And I should say that we are due to speak to Azerbaijan's ambassador to the UK later this week. And we will, of course, put all the issues raised in that discussion to him when we do talk to him. But that is it for this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.